In just a moment, keys to the Capitol. But first, news coverage at its best is yours here on NBC all through the week. Monday through Friday, you'll hear veteran reporters and commentators like Leon Pearson, Alex Dreyer, Morgan Beatty, and many others who bring you the news as it happens in the complete and accurate manner you want. And on weekends, you'll hear a special series of programs that introduce you to the people who make headlines. There's Meet the Press, Youth Wants to Know, the American Forum of the Air, and many, many more. Keep informed the easy, the complete way, the NBC radio way. And now stay tuned for Keys to the Capitol on NBC.
What's going on in Washington?
President shows signs of throwing his weight around politically.
It's still Joe McCarthy.
A troublesome senator is no novelty.
And the Capitol may get a professional police force at last.
From Washington, NBC News brings you transcribed Keys to the Capitol, a weekly news program in which the National Broadcasting Company's top Washington reporters and commentators discuss with you the news of the week and what's behind it. Tonight you will hear Ray Scherer, Leif Eve, Earl Godwin, and David Brinkley. NBC News has given these men the weekly assignment of going through Washington's official doors to learn the background of our national policy. We bring you now Keys to the Capitol. And first, here's NBC's White House correspondent, Ray Scherer.
Well, you know, gentlemen, one of the things that impresses me these days is that the closer we get to the adjournment of Congress, the more political things get around here. The atomic energy filibuster was shot through with campaign politics. And so was the McCarthy censure debate. Senators afraid to take a stand on McCarthy this close to an election. The president, and this is what I'd really like to talk about, finds himself up to the elbows in politics, too. The president has been shifting his ground a good deal. In the 1952 campaign, he gave his support to all Republican candidates. A few months ago, it appeared the president would not endorse any candidates this year. At least he wasn't going to get mixed up in local contests. It so happens that during the last couple of weeks, and I've counted them, more than 120 congressmen running for re-election have trooped into the White House to have their pictures snapped with the president. Campaign pictures. The White House has let it be known that voting records of these men are checked before the photo is taken with the president, this to see if the men generally support him. In other words, the president isn't supporting just anybody. But there are some ticklish cases. Now, suppose there's a man on the Republican ticket with no voting record on national legislation, a man who differs in philosophy with the president. We had a case like that in Illinois. Joseph Meek, running for the Senate against Democrat Paul Douglas. Meek was for the Bricker Amendment. He supports McCarthy. He's pretty right-wing generally. Would the president endorse him? That was the question. Meek wrote a letter to the president pledging his loyalty. The president wrote back. He was glad to hear that. He hoped to greet Meek in January as the junior senator from Illinois. Ike needs a Republican Senate. Meek needs the president's support to win. The president will be speaking all around come September. Earl Godwin, have you ever seen a president who didn't play a little campaign politics?
No, I never saw a duck that wouldn't go into water either. I think that a large part of some of the presidential politics is brought on by the people around him that didn't want to lose their job that shoved him into it. Like Cal Coolidge, you know, he was the least political in his actions, I think, as far as the surface is concerned. And newspaper photographers used to have to work very hard to get him even to put on a funny hat and be...
Put them on, though.
Yeah, he put them on.
He looked pretty funny
one time. Indian feathers one time.
Put on an Indian headdress, and that was politics for Coolidge.
Well, earlier, back when Cal finally up and said he didn't choose to run again, were the people around him trying to get him to run? Is that true?
Oh, yes. The crowd that's on the payroll wanted to run. There's no doubt about that. I think that in historically... William McKinley was probably as far from acting politically as anybody that we would find. He liked to sit on the front porch, things of that kind.
But, yeah,
we are so used to the dynamic and gigantic and everlasting politics of Roosevelt and Truman. It's hard to think of a president that isn't acting politically at the right moment.
Well, how would you class Mr. Eisenhower? He's still sort of new at this thing. Is he sort of an in-betweener? on as a politician.
I think he's a little behind her.
I don't agree with that, Earl. I think that the president has finally learned the facts of political life. The closest thing we've got is to a national party boss is the president of the United States. He's the boss of the dominant party. He's got to get out there and pitch to help his guys get in.
That's true, but
if he wants his program.
He asked me what I thought, and I told you.
Oh, yeah. Well, he's a political climber yet.
Yeah, no, that's perfectly true. I think he's a little slow on it, and he certainly is not dramatic. He doesn't do the crazy thing, doesn't jump through a hoop just for politics, and I think that he's probably, his idea of doing the right thing is his political thinking.
Ray mentioned Joe Meek in Illinois pledging his support to the president's program. I don't understand that too well. How can he pledge his support when publicly in the past he has differed completely with Eisenhower on so many things? Is he going to change on all those, do you suppose?
That's what it seems to mean. He says, I'm going to support you. I believe in your principles. He certainly hasn't up till now. Apparently, the president now takes this at its face value and says, thank you for your loyalty. I'm glad to hear it. I'm glad to have you on my side.
Well, he has never been loyal to the president's program until now, when apparently he wants his support.
Well,
isn't that kind of hard to understand.
That's static, isn't it? In politics, he wants the president's support, so he jumps on the bandwagon. Sure.
There's something to be gained by both sides.
If there's time on this thing, let me ask you, Ray, your opinion of the interesting situation in Kentucky where Senator Cooper will oppose Alvin Barkley, who is Mr. Democrat. The Republicans would just like to knock off Barkley as a conspicuous victory, in that to support Cooper, General Eisenhower, President Eisenhower would be supporting a man who was against him in this TVA matter, in the atomic energy bill.
Well, you know, Earl, the president was asked specifically about that at his news conference. The president said he wouldn't support a candidate unless this man more or less believed as he did. The reporter got up and said, well, now, what about John Cooper? Cooper voted against you twice in this atomic energy program. Does that mean you won't support him? And the president said, well, no. A man didn't have to support him 100%. He believed Cooper. Cooper had a splendid record. Cooper had come to him when they had differences, and then he certainly was going to support Cooper. So he apparently considers Cooper pretty much an Eisenhower Republican, although he said that I think Mr. Cooper is wrong on this one. You know, the president has made one trip to Kentucky already to help Mr. Cooper.
I think
Cooper is a pretty good Eisenhower supporter.
Perfect, too.
Look over his record. It's only on this one where TVA is important in Western Kentucky.
He has a special interest.
Yeah,
local affair.
Well, it is of importance to the Republicans to defeat Barkley if he can.
If he can do it, yeah.
It would be a tremendous victory, mm-hmm. a dramatic thing, wouldn't mm-hmm. it? I imagine that President Eisenhower will do all he can.
Well, as I say, he's made one trip through Kentucky. He had Cooper with him all day long. I suspect maybe he may even make another one down there. What do you think is the most interesting Senate race coming up, Lee?
The most interesting one?
Yeah, there are a lot of interesting ones, the Kentucky one, the Illinois one.
Kentucky one is one that's sort of loaded against the Republicans because normally it's a Democratic state. They have a pretty good chance of knocking off Paul Douglas in Illinois because that's, if I understand, the Republican machine out there is pretty well patched up now and it's working pretty well.
Well, now suppose they defeat Douglas in Illinois and Douglas turns out to have been a much closer Eisenhower type man than Meek was. Then what?
I don't know. You wait till the next Congress.
Well, what are you fellas? Is there any interest at all in Iowa? I think Gillette is running there.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, there's a state where long ago the old Republicans would say that Iowa is going to remain Republican until Hades goes Methodist. Well, of course, it has gone Democratic. Right? And I heard today from an Iowa man who is not a professional politician, a politician at all, that Gillette had a very good chance of being reelected simply because they liked him out there. Is that an interesting race?
The case where he's stronger than the party, isn't it?
Possibly.
Well, speaking of politics, gentlemen, there's still Joe McCarthy. And I think one of the most amazing things of this Congress is Majority Leader Bill Nola's sudden and unexplained agreement to interrupt the drive for adjournment, a drive to power the Eisenhower program through, just to let the senators holler themselves out about Joe McCarthy. Not that they've shouted themselves out yet. They've only got themselves in deeper, for the moment, anyway. They've got themselves a special committee now. The committee is supposed to come back with some sort of report before the end of Congress. It might only be a report that they haven't got a report. But there it is, a chance that the senators will get themselves all tangled up again. Well, why did Nolan change? First, he was dead set against the Flanders resolution to censure Joe McCarthy. He said he'd move to table it as soon as Flanders brought it up. And that would have cut the affair dead right there, if he'd carried it, because you can't debate a motion to table. Then Nolan said all right, then he'd let the boys have all the time they wanted to debate the Flanders resolution, even if it took 3 days or even longer. But he still said he was against it. Finally, Nolan himself came up with a proposal to refer the whole thing to a select committee, probably still in the hope somehow that if he could get it off the Senate floor, it would go away. But he still had to accept Senator Ives's amendment that the committee report back by the 10th of August or by the end of Congress, whichever comes earlier. The only way I can figure it is if Nolan found out by counting noses that he just didn't have the vote. That with the Senate divided so evenly between the Republicans and Democrats, there were enough Republicans willing to vote against killing the Flanders resolution by tabling it, that he might have been licked, and he'd be in a worse mess than ever. It's still a remarkable thing that the leadership in the drive on for adjournment and getting the program through before adjournment, before the 14th of August, as a matter of fact, allow us time out for a slugfest over a member of its own party. Don't you think so, Dave?
Well, it had to, Lee, didn't they?
I don't see why they had to. They probably could have counted noses and figured on getting Joe McCarthy out because he's a hot political issue.
What do you mean, get him out?
Get him off the calendar.
Well, if suppose they had done that, just passed over Flanders resolution, killed it some way or other, wouldn't that have made a good campaign issue?
It all depends on how many Democrats would have gone along. Of course, the Democrats could have gone out of town all of a sudden and let the Republicans do it. Sure, they could do that.
Well, since they've taken the course they have, the one you've just described, it seems to me they're in a terrible mess. They've got this committee which no one is very anxious to serve on. Nobody knows what it can do once it does begin. What are they going to do? Return a verdict for or against McCarthy? Are they going to find him guilty or not guilty? Or what?
Apparently, all the committee is supposed to do is to take the Flanders Amendment and all the little charges that have been offered as amendments, the specific charges,
and study
them and whip them into shape and return them to the Senate. So they're putting it right back to the Senate.
Well, saw what happened in the McCarthy Army hearing when they took about two charges. Well, and it took to find out the truth about them. That took 36 days, and they never did find out the truth.
There are 50 allegations in this thing. Some are more serious than others. And maybe if you recall last night or yesterday, Senator Homer Ferguson made a rather ominous remark that this thing has aspects of a criminal case as well as anything else. And it does seem to me to be utterly ridiculous to expect that those six men with Joe McCarthy there cross-examining the alleges of 50 wrongs to get out of here and get anything concrete and sensible by August 14th.
Is there any proposition or any proposal that Joe McCarthy be permitted to cross-examine?
He says he wants to.
But that's not usual with
the government. No, it is not. But I just throw that in to show that if he does, why, it'll be a...
And the way
they'll be here all summer.
The kind of committee that they're talking about, this Blue Ribbon Committee, with a couple of elder statesmen heading each side, doesn't seem to me that McCarthy would be allowed to cross-examine.
I think you're perfectly right about that. If you got
Walter George on one
Walter
side
George,
and Dean Milliken on the other side, they would agree that we've got to uphold the dignity and the honor of this Senate and so forth, and not allow ourselves to get embroiled in something Army McCarthy hearing.
Suppose, for instance, that this thing is all nice and smooth. They have the elder statesmen there, and they bring back this thing on August 14th. What do they do? Leave it there in the Senate? Will they come back? Because if they start the gate again in the Senate to debate on what the select committee does, they'll be here for another 2 years. It has been done.
No, Congress ends next January 3rd.
No, but they'll have it on the next.
I don't see any possible way they can clean this thing up to anyone's satisfaction in any short time. By short, I mean 2 weeks or 3 weeks or a month.
I think they've adopted the standard routine, and when you got a problem and don't know what to do about it, you appoint a committee.
Yeah, and then have some conferences out in the hallway and decide what to do about it.
People have been doing that.
You mean the committee will decide to recess and deliberate some more at some later date? I mean, it's sort of get to be looking for another witness who can't quite come to the committee now, so we will have a meeting soon.
All kinds of little things like that. I certainly don't see how they could study, even begin to study. 46. I think there are 46 charges against McCarthy made during this debate by three or four of his colleagues. How they could begin to study 46 charges and find out whether they were true or false, calling all the witnesses and looking at all the documents, and to return with any kind of report or verdict or recommendation in less than several months at the least.
Well, Dave, a lot of those things, of course, are appended as part of the bill of particulars are not things that call for any investigation. They're things that the Senate already knows about.
Well, they already know about all of them, but they still say they should study them before they take any action.
You mean study, hear witnesses and so on?
Sure, everything that was mentioned on the Senate floor, everyone on the floor had already heard, already knew about it. Everyone in the Senate knows McCarthy, good or bad, they know McCarthy. And, but they still preferred to study the issue, as though they'd never seen McCarthy before.
The President...
I don't see anything for it, but it's just another tangled mess like that, like that Army-McCarthy hearing. It winds up proving nothing.
The President indicated...
Well, now, gentlemen, the Senate's had trouble with senators ever since the second Congress. There's been practically almost a trouble a year with between the Senate and some senator, or between the Senate and somebody who wanted to be senator. And the first man they had trouble with got a statue out here on Pennsylvania Avenue right now. It's Albert Gallatin, who was denied the Senate seat because he hadn't been a United States citizen long enough. He'd been born in Switzerland, and That wasn't any row, wasn't a scandalous procedure such as this, but most of the troubles that they've had have been from something that's happened outside the Senate in election time, and only maybe not half a dozen occurrences have half a dozen senators have been censured or fired for something that happened in the Senate, unless it was in the Civil War era where they were shucking out Democrats over the tailgate. Almost just by calling their name, but then in the fist fight between Pitchfork Ben Tillman and his South Carolina colleague whose name is, what was it, McLaurin, they had a fist fight.
John Rankin had a fist fight once too, didn't he?
Not in the House. Yeah, they've had some fights over there.
That wasn't the late.
But they,
couple of cream puffs.
Then the case of Hiram Bingham in 1929, he was a Republican senator from Connecticut, and he was writing up a tariff bill, a high tariff, so he brought in a high tariff lobbyist, made him a member of his staff, and that so outraged the Democrats that they made almost a moral issue out of it. But they fought, bled, and died over that thing for two solid years before they censured Mr. Hiram Bingham.
2 years?
What?
2 years they fought over
it? I think they did. Not a continuous fight, but my recollection is from the time it started to the time it ended, it was a long time. And then there was...
Well, members of the Senate are notoriously slow to get mad at each other, aren't they?
Well, there was another long stretched out thing when Henry Ford was elected to the Senate by the Democrats of... at least he ran for the Senate. And Truman Newberry, who was a Republican nominee, he won. And the charge against Truman Newberry was that they had violated the state law on campaigns a million times over. I think that Michigan allowed you to spend in those days about $3,500 in the primary. Newberry's gang spent more than $500,000. And it was a long, long, drawn-out fight. And I think the Senate or the committee... fired Newberry once, took him back, and finally it seated Newberry, but he resigned because he said the seat was very uncomfortable. He couldn't have it. Then they had...
You don't suppose that was by prearrangement, do you?
I don't know, but it was... those were eras when money troubles were in politics. Bill Vair, Republican boss in Philadelphia. He'd been in the House, they ran for the Senate, and they just loaded his campaign down with money. And then Frank Smith in Illinois, back in the, just before the 30s. Sam Insull, the utility man, gave cartloads of money to both sides, to Frank Smith and to Brennan, who was, the Democratic National Committeeman, or he was running anyhow for the Senate. And that took an awful lot of time. It was over 2 years on that. And finally, after they declared the Illinois seat vacant. And Len Small then immediately reappointed the same Smith, and he came up to the Senate door that had nothing doing. We've passed on you before. And then somebody died, and they had an election, and the Smith was defeated, and that ended him for good and all. So an awful lot of those things. You fellas remember.
Providence stepped in and saved the Senate from making up its mind a lot.
And there was a charge of treason made against old man La Follette, the elder La Follette, during World War I, and that lasted, I think those charges took 8 or 10 months to shift out. Finally,
An official charge of treason,
not in the Senate, but a patriotic group in Minnesota.
Well, that's the way he voted on the Declaration.
Things of that sort. That took 10 months. It took 10 solid months on that thing. And they were, you fellas remember, and Bill Langer, you remember Senator Langer of North Dakota? Well, you can hardly talk about that thing without almost libeling somebody. There were so many charges of graft, corruption, and bribery. And finally, something like this happened. Well, maybe it's so, but North Dakota knew it anyhow. Let's let him in, boys. I think it was 3 years in getting to that.
He has since been reelected once, hasn't he?
Yeah.
Sure.
Well, there have been an awful lot. Of course, a lot of fellows on the House side that were had eccentricities and troubles and so forth. And I remember when I was a boy, Buck Kilgore, a congressman from Texas, kicked the door in. Speaker Reed didn't like the Democrats, went out into the cloakroom or into the lobby when they asked for quorum. So he said, lock the doors, and they counted them all, and this fellow Kilgore had on great big cowboy boots, and he kicked the door down. Well, nothing ever happened to him. That was just excitement.
Just put up a new door.
You fellas remember a lot of those things are more recent than that, I'll bet.
Well, there was Zionchek, for example. He was a problem for a while, just a few years ago. He used to take baths in the fountain out in front of the Capitol.
He got in the pool up in Rockefeller Center up in New York.
Also got in pools here.
Mm-hmm.
At night. It's closed.
Well, I just want to point out to you that as far as the Senate's concerned, they seem to have some kind of a senatorial rash in every Senate, every Congress. There have been 179 years of Congress and about 130 troublesome senators.
You remember in the House, when was this? About 4 years ago when the street sweeper in, was it Minneapolis, Milwaukee?
Well, sure.
Gallagher was his name?
Yeah, what did he do?
Yeah.
He got elected to the House on some fluke or other. How'd that happen? I've forgotten it. His name was Gallagher. He came here and served a while and then died, didn't he? Leaf, do you remember him?
Yeah, I remember. He'd been a former streetcar motorman, and then he got a job sweeping streets. I've forgotten how he got in.
He lived in one of the flop house hotels.
It was just one of those flukes where everybody voted for Gallagher, I think.
I think the opposite.
Without any campaign, yeah.
He had a pretty strong name, so he...
Here's something I'd like to throw in here and let you chew on. We've been hearing a lot lately about the Eisenhower legislative program, tax revision, foreign aid, and so on. But there's a very interesting, if largely unknown, little piece of legislation in the works up there, and it's one I think most people won't have heard much about. It's a bill to set up a new police force for the United States Capitol, a well-trained, well-equipped, professional force. What they have now, of course, as you know, is a purely political organization of the police appointed on a patronage basis. That is, the members of Congress divide up the privilege of appointing members of the force, and they usually appoint their friends who need jobs, whether they know anything about police work or not. But what started this bill to set up the professional force was, of course, a shooting in the House gallery a few months ago when the Puerto Ricans got in carrying guns, got in undetected, and shot 5 members of Congress. Well, they decided after that they should have better protection, so this bill now is in the works, and I think the House passed it this week. One of the most entertaining stories I know about the Capitol Police Force is some years old, but it's pretty good, I think. It happened back during the Teapot Dome investigation and also during Prohibition. A friend of mine, who now lives in Washington, was going to Georgetown Law School in those days, and he needed a part-time job to help pay his expenses. So he got his congressman to appoint him to the Capitol Police Force. He was a young boy in his early 20s. Of course, he knew nothing about police work, but he was assigned to the House office building in uniform at night as a policeman. He spent most of his time studying for his schoolwork the next day. Well, then one day a very prominent, I won't mention his name, but a prominent Democratic member of the House got from some friend of his a very handsome gift. It was a great big mahogany chest trimmed with brass, very fancy, about the size of a double steamer trunk. It was a beautiful thing. And it was filled almost to the top with miniature bottles of fine Canadian whiskey. Now, this was during Prohibition, remember? And then across the top of the chest was a layer of boxes of fine Cuban cigars. Well, this congressman was so pleased and delighted and so proud, he hardly knew what to say. He showed it off all around his office, and that night when he went home, he locked it up. Well, the members of the police force didn't take long to find out about it. That night, while my friend was on duty, some members of the force with their pass keys went into the congressman's office, stole the chest, the whiskey, and the cigars, and dragged it down into the basement of the House office building somewhere behind the boiler room. They spent the rest of the night, several nights thereafter, sitting down there drinking whiskey and smoking cigars and having themselves a fine time. Well, the next morning, the congressman came in and found his chest was gone, and he was, as they say, transported with rage. He was livid with anger. He boiled over to the House floor and made a speech and said his office had been robbed during the night. He was furious. The thieves had stolen a chest full of documents about the Teapot Dome investigation. He said he wanted the police to find it and bring it back. Well, of course, the police looked long and hard, but they just somehow never were able to find it. I don't think things like that happen anymore, but it shows you what can happen if you hire a policeman who doesn't know a thief when he sees one. Maybe
he's one himself.
It's an inside job.
Purely inside job.
Yeah, I remember speaking to a congressman now and then about their what patronage they had left. I want to get a job for a friend or something like that. He said, I've got one-third of a policeman.
That yeah, I've heard of that, too.
He can have a policeman, appoint a policeman for one-third of a year.
The new congressmen usually run up against that problem. They go around and ask the party boss, and say, how much patronage have I got? And they give them one half of a page boy or something.
Or a fourth of an elevator operator.
A fourth of an elevator operator. I remember seeing the Speaker of the House of Mississippi at one time running an elevator in the House office building because he'd come up there to be the reading clerk of the House. That he was a logical man, and finally he had the had to pay up his board bill, so he got somebody to make him. I think he was one-third of an elevator operator. So,
well, suppose I have two-thirds of an elevator operator and you have one-third of a policeman. Can we match these together
sure,
and come
sure,
up with,
sure.
with a whole...
Yeah, you can trade around so you can get a whole job. Mm-hmm. Whole man.
You can give your third to somebody.
What I'd like to know is if they're going to hire a professional police force up here, what are the boys going to do for patronage?
Well, does that put in more elevators?
I wish there were some. You ever try to ride one of those?
Oh, Lord, they're awful. Those elevators in the Capitol are about the size of two phone booths, if that big. And the tourists and other people trying to get in and into and out of the Capitol are always jammed
up. Well, the ones for the senators aren't jammed.
Well, of course, they keep elevators reserved for themselves with a sign over the door saying, Senators Only.
Well, you ring three times.
I will make a wager with you that when Congressman... lose their patronage on policemen, they'll start something else.
Yeah,
they probably will.
Hedge clippers or lawnmowers or something like that.
Parking
attendants out front there.
Research staff.
They got to have those jobs.
Oh, what's happened in this case is that they were so scared by the Puerto Ricans that they decided to give up their patronage for protection. Is that what it comes down
that's,
to?
That's
they gave up their patronage literally at gunpoint.
You've been listening to Keys to the Capitol, brought to you transcribed by NBC News, as a way of taking you behind the doors of official Washington with NBC's top reporters and commentators. Tonight you've heard Ray Scherer, Lee Veed, Earl Godwin, and David Brinkley. Keys to the Capitol will be brought to you at this same time each week. This program came to you from Washington. This is the NBC Radio Network.